Support for this program provided by Girdwood, Alaska. Take a drive down the scenic highway past Beluga Point. Hike Bird Ridge and enjoy what Girdwood has to offer. Exploring your home state is the COVID-safe way to enjoy the summer.
Welcome to Native America Calling. From Albuquerque, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Homelessness in Native America is a persistent issue. Tribes and local groups do the best they can to implement programs that help unsheltered relatives with food, temporary shelter, and employment. In the past few years, tiny home villages have sprouted up and are a new option for unsheltered people to transition into more stable living situations. Join us after the news as we talk about tiny home villages and discuss how transitional housing works.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause, in for Antonia Gonzalez. On Saturday, the U.S. Senate confirmed the nomination of Brian Newland to Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs. Newland is the former president of the Babe Mills Indian Community, based in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. A major step recently in advancing the Métis peoples of Manitoba right to self-government. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the province's Métis Federation has signed a recognition and implementation agreement.
The deal recognizes the Métis of Manitoba people's right to self-government. It also recognizes the Federation's authority over citizenship, leadership selection, elections, and the running of their government on behalf of the Métis of Manitoba. It's a step that lays out what happens next to recognize the MMF as an Indigenous government under Canadian law. David Chartrand, the president of the MMF, says justice is now being achieved and it's something his people have fought for.
We've always been a government and no one will ever take that from us. We are the only truly recognized government province-wide in this country of Canada. That is a powerful statement being made by Canada. This is a legal, legitimate document. And I hope that every party listening out there, I ask you now, if you're going to challenge this agreement, challenge it now.
But not all are as satisfied as Chartrand. The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs says Ottawa did not consider the implications to the inherent and treaty rights of First Nations. As the original treaty partners of the Crown, they argue First Nations have yet to be given the right to self-governance. Chief Arlen Duma says Canada has now clearly signaled it prioritizes the Métis over First Nations, people who claim rights and land that have existed long before the Métis came to be. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
This summer, Canada closed most of British Columbia's commercial salmon fisheries. Declining stocks were to blame for the drastic conservation measures. As KSTKA's Sage Smiley reports, Southeast Alaska shares coastline and transboundary rivers with BC. So what could this mean for the region?
Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada, the federal agency that manages Canada's fisheries, effectively ended the 2021 commercial salmon season on the West Coast in late June. Canada's fishing industry was stunned, says BC Seafood Alliance Executive Director Christina Burridge.
First Nations have harvested salmon forever, and post-contact salmon canneries are what in a sense built this province. And to be now in this situation seems really tragic to me.
The closure came just weeks after Canada announced a more than $500 million plan to revitalize its flagging Pacific salmon stocks in BC and Yukon Territory. So what does Canada's salmon shutdown mean for its Alaska neighbors? From a marketing standpoint, not much, says McKinley Research Analyst Dan Lesh in Juneau.
Alaska dwarfs BC, and so anything that happens in those markets is not going to be a big impact on our fisheries.
BC's largest wild salmon market is Chinook, about 14% of the global market in recent years. But its shares of the other four salmon species represent less than 2% of worldwide production. State fisheries managers say BC's experience isn't likely to be repeated in Alaska. Drastic measures like widespread closures aren't in the nature of Alaska's dynamic management, where biologists can time openings at will. U.S. states and Canadian provinces work cooperatively to co-manage transboundary salmon runs through the Pacific Salmon Treaty. But the Canadian government says the shutdown on their end likely won't affect current allocations, as the treaty won't be renegotiated until 2028. For National Native News in Wrangell, Alaska, I'm Sage Smiley.
Celebrated artist and Cherokee National Treasure Laureen Drywater died July 30th. She was 89. Drywater was known for her buffalo grass dolls and as an expert seamstress of traditional clothing. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme. This show is supported by the FX original series, Reservation Dogs. From Sterling Harjo and Taika Waititi, Reservation Dogs follows the adventures of four indigenous teens in rural Oklahoma. Reservation Dogs, now streaming exclusively FX on Hulu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The homes in a housing complex recently completed in Albuquerque are only about 120 square feet each. That's about the size of a bedroom. The structures built next to the Albuquerque American Indian Center and are transitional homes for people experiencing homelessness. Such tiny homes are part of a trend by some tribes, advocacy groups, and cities to build more shelters in both urban and rural areas. A group on the Menominee tribe in Wisconsin is in the middle of building Tiny Home Village. The Puyallup tribes also finished construction of a tiny home village. And the concept is not always welcome. Nearby residents are often weary of development of tiny home shelters. This hour, we're going to talk about tiny homes. We want you to join the conversation. Our phone lines are open. Give us a call. Don't wait till the end of the program. Get on in early in the conversation by calling us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have some guests joining us today. Joining us from Seattle is Colleen Echohawk, the founder of the National Coalition to End Urban Indigenous Homelessness. She's Pawnee and Athabascan. Welcome to Native America Calling.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
And also joining us from here in Albuquerque is Ilsa Beal, and she's the resource manager at the Tiny Home Village in Albuquerque. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for including me. Hello.
Well, Colleen, let's go ahead and start off a little bit about talking about you've been involved in addressing, coming up with ideas and discussions and looking at solutions for a long time when it comes to unsheltered relatives. Why is it important to look at different innovations, different solutions, and trying to help our people?
Oh, what a great and thoughtful question. I think the first thing we need to be really aware of is that, you know, around the country, and actually this is a global statistic, in urban centers, Native people have the highest rates of homelessness. And I think that for a very long time, our policymakers out there kind of just ignored the fact, and, you know, wanted to cover it up because it's uncomfortable for them. But I think it's been very, very important in the past 5-10 years. We've seen a lot of our Native community just coming together and saying, enough is enough. Like, it is unacceptable that our relatives have the highest rates of homelessness out there. And I believe that the innovation that you're talking about comes directly from the Native community who's experienced, you know, the impact of homelessness the most. And I am seeing just around the country just beautiful, wonderful things happening where we're building our own housing, supporting our relatives from coming to come inside, and innovating around, you know, housing opportunities as well as, you know, other you know, innovation around mental health and addiction support. So I think it's a really exciting time for Indian country, and I'm excited to, you know, continue this conversation with you all today.
And also, can you expand on why it's both important for addressing unsheltered Indigenous people, both in rural and urban areas, you know, covering this issue a long time for
different news stories and talking to advocacy groups and just grassroots members of the community, often reminding people that all land is Indigenous land, a traditional territory of different groups. So, you know, when people, there's a lot of different contributing factors of why people, Indigenous people, are experiencing homelessness, you know, traveling back for jobs, maybe they're in university settings, maybe there's some mental health issues. There's a lot of different contributing factors, but also just reminding people about, you know, this is, they belong here. We belong here. It's traditional territory. Go ahead, Colleen.
Oh, well, again, what a thoughtful question. You know, we know that the impact of the Urban Indian Relocation Act has had very, very long-term effects. You know, we're seeing it to this day where we have, you know, a huge amount of urban Native people, Native people living in urban settings on tribal lands. Exactly right. You know, I'm in Seattle right now, which is named after a chief, and yet we have, you know, very little foothold here in some ways. We're working on it, but there's you know we're kind of pushed out and marginalized, and so really finding ways to push back and be a strong voice and advocate for our community is really important. Until about 6 months ago, I was the executive director at the Chief Seattle Club, which is a leading agency in Seattle around building affordable housing and supporting the homeless community. It's now led by one of my dear, dear friends, Derek Belgard. And, you know, the Chief Seattle Club, we really pushed for, you know, Native people to be recognized in every single place that we could, in every data point, in every place where we could be pushing, you know, Native style of housing, our Native styles of trying to make sure that we're supporting each other in a culturally relevant and important, relevant way so that we can, you know, have services that actually make sense to our relatives out there. And the other thing I'll just mention, you gave me such a nice a pillow to kind of land this question on, is that the other thing that is so wonderful about where we're at right now is that we can be pushing for services that acknowledge that we are on tribal lands, acknowledge that, hey, this is tribal lands that we are on in this city, and thus we should have services that respond to those needs of our tribal communities that live in these centers, in urban centers. So it's a really exciting time to be pushing out our innovations, our styles of housing, our responses to the critical situations that some of our relatives are in. And I want to invite people to check out our website. It's endurbanindigenoushomelessness.org. That gives a lot more detail and shares about what's going on around the country with folks who have been in this battle for a while.
Well, thank you for sharing that, and we'll make sure to get that information out as well. And Ilsa, one of the things that is here in Albuquerque that I mentioned in the beginning is looking at transitional housing and the tiny homes. What are tiny homes?
For one thing, the whole structure is not just the actual home, but it's then the whole site, and this happens throughout the country. The whole site is built on nurturing community. So the homes are deliberately small to encourage people to not just isolate themselves, seclude, but get out into the community, help build that community. And then there are the various styles of community living. So in our case, we've got 30 of these small homes, as you had said, 120 square feet. It's basically a bedroom, but that's the private space. And then the intermediary space is the porch that's attached to each of these homes. And then all the other amenities are communal. And it's basically that intervention of allowing for a group of folks to really start building a new community when they've lost their street community, they've got something else to replace that with. I think that is one of the key interventions of this model.
And thank you for sharing that. We have someone who is on the phone line with us right now. We have a caller from the Lummi Nation, Nicholas. What I understand is, welcome to the program. And what I understand is there's a tiny home village there and the Lummi Nation. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Yeah, hey, thank you for taking the time to let me speak a little bit. My name is Nicholas Lewis. I'm a council member for the Lummi Nation, our tribe of about 5,000 people up here in Washington State. I also am the chairman of the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board and the vice chairman on the National Indian Health Board. And just want to take a moment and appreciate the conversation when we're talking about homelessness and using tiny homes as an option to help. But we have a small nonprofit called Lummi Stepping Stones. We've been running a volunteer nonprofit over the last about 5 years now. And we started off with two homes that are kind of community living, so to speak. In Native culture, intergenerational living was common practice, and trying to kind of utilize community living to go back to that. And what we started to see was over time, community living doesn't suit everybody's needs the right way, the way that we had hoped. So we started with a goal of developing a tiny home village. And it started off just as a dream from some of our community members. And fast forward to today, we've raised, I believe, $3.6 million. We just hired our architects to design the tiny home village. The tribe did purchase an old RV park that we are converting to the tiny home village. And what we are going to be doing is the homes will be varying sizes. I think the first one that we built is about 300 square feet. This next one is going to be a little bit smaller. But the idea is that it'll be able to accommodate single people up to small families. And we have an MOU with our behavioral health, because when we talk about addressing homelessness, it's not just a house that will solve the problem. It's bringing services to them. And one of the things that we believe in is not making people go to services. People are struggling just to find a place to live. They're going to have a struggle trying to get to services. That's not their first priority, is to go to medical care. So we have an MOU with our behavioral health department and our health team so that we can provide on-site health care needs in the village. And so that's kind of the model that we're working on. In the nonprofit that that I mentioned, Lummi Stepping Stones, in the 5 years, what we have seen is about 50% steadily have been children under the age of 17 that have called our home their home.
Hold that thought, Nicholas. We have to go to break here and we'll come back to this conversation. You're listening to Native America Calling, and today we're talking about helping unsheltered relatives and looking at ideas and finding solutions. And we have some guests, but our phone lines are open as well. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Give us a call. Get in on the conversation. We want to hear from you. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back. The good news is Native Americans are vaccinated against COVID-19 at a higher rate than the general population. The bad news, new variants of the virus pose additional threats, and misinformation about preventing infections continues to cause confusion. We'll get updates on COVID-19 trends on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today, we're taking a look at some ideas to address the unsheltered relatives across the country and even transitional housing, which includes tiny home villages. What do you think? Have you seen some around? Maybe you have one in your community. Maybe you've even been in this situation and these homes have helped you get into permanent housing. Give us a call. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have some guests joining us this hour to talk about this. Here in Albuquerque is Ilsa Beal. Welcome back. And also joining us from Seattle is Colleen Echohawk. Thank you both for being here. And I want to go back to our phone lines as well, because we had a Lummi Nation representative on the phone, Nicholas, and sorry we had to cut you off, but we had to take a quick break. Nicholas, go ahead and finish. You were talking a little bit about these homes and receiving funding to get the project started.
Yeah. So I kind of wanted to go back to, you know, what we've seen is about half of our residents, over 50%, have been children. And when we talk about homelessness, you know, and Colleen can echo this, I'm sure, as well, but people think of homelessness with a stigma of what we see in cities and urban areas, or what we see people on the side of the roads. We assume the worst of what homelessness is. And what we're trying to focus on specifically for Lummi and the work that we're doing is shifting that narrative. You know, in 1 year, we had 7 newborns born into our shelter from families that didn't have a home, and breaking that stigma. They didn't choose to be homeless. You know, we've seen a lot of our people that chose to be homeless because they were fleeing domestic violence. And one of the things you see in COVID, we told people to shelter in place for over a year. Oftentimes, when you look at domestic violence, it affects Native communities at the highest rate. And, you know, we as governments told people to stay home, and a lot of services were offline. And so we're really trying to shift the narrative of what homelessness is. It's not what people fear. And it's really trying to break that stigma and give our people a chance to be who they want to be. And stabilized housing with tiny homes is a big portion of that. We are sponsored by the Lac-Mich Foundation. It's our parent non-sponsor, and we are working on a fundraising campaign to raise the additional funding to complete the tiny home village. As I mentioned, we've raised about $3.6 million to date. We're told we need to raise a total of $6.6 million for the project. And we're working towards it, because when we see these children that are in our shelters and often affected by homelessness, it makes it very personal, as it should for all of us. They didn't deserve to have that label, like what they often get labeled as, and trying to do what our ancestors did and break the cycle for our future. So, thank you.
And Nicholas, you spoke a little bit about taking this approach, and why was it important to have this cultural response and looking back at, you know, tribal traditions, culture, and also just that, you know, key value of helping one another in community?
I think when you look at a lot of the services that are out there, they don't incorporate those type of things. And one of the things that we always talk about here in Lummi, our kind of mission statement of our tribe, is to preserve, promote, and protect our Shillelagh and our way of life. And I think when we're talking about that, it is making sure that we take care of one another as our ancestors did for us. They sacrificed the world as they knew it for us today. And while there's still struggles today, we wouldn't be here without their sacrifices on behalf of us. And I think we're just trying to get back to those and making that the focal point of work, and breaking this cycle, this trauma that has been passed down for far too long. And it tiny homes are going to be an amazing opportunity for a lot of people, because normalized housing, larger housing, doesn't fit everybody. Community living doesn't fit everybody. When we're tackling this issue, it's a multiple prong approach that we need. And I think that as we see more tiny home villages come online, they will provide a much needed opportunity and a chance for people that are trying to do everything they can. And so it's a hand up, kind of not a handout kind of thought approach.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and joining us today. I know you got a busy schedule and got to jump off the call, but is there, Nicholas, anything else you want to share?
I think in closing, just when we talk about this, remember that it's somebody's child. It's somebody's brother. It's somebody's sister. It's somebody's aunt, somebody's uncle, somebody's grandparents or grandchild. And, you know, people that are struggling for one reason or another aren't always choosing to be that way. And we need to do a better job of breaking the stigma that we have against people that are struggling. We need to remember who we are and care for one another. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in and joining us today. And Colleen, there's a lot that Nicholas had to say about what the Lummi Nation is doing, and also just reminding people and, you know, addressing that stigma. Any comments to what Nicholas shared?
Oh, so many. Just a huge shout out and love to Nicholas. We've known each other for a long time, and just really admire you, brother, and the work that you're doing out there in Lummi. And, you know, there's something I just think is really important to bring up in this conversation. You know, we've been talking about tiny homes and the impact. And one thing, and I want to say this really carefully, I absolutely support the tiny home innovation that's been happening around Indian country right now. And I want to make clear, though, that it is emergency housing. It is transitional housing. It is not permanent housing. And I think that with the disparity that we know around housing insecurity for Native communities, it is absolutely vital that we be laser focused on permanent housing that is affordable and abundant and beautiful and it shelters our community in a way that is dignified and honors the humanity, like in every single person, like Nicholas was talking about. You know, I struggle sometimes with the tiny homes because often they don't have a bathroom. They used to not have, you know, even a, like heater. Now most of them have heater and lighting, but you know, they don't have a bathroom, and many of them don't. They don't have showers, and I know that they're important for that transitional period, but we've got to be careful that we don't build too many of them. You know, we've got to make sure that we are laser focused on that permanent housing. And I am very excited about having, you know, new HUD Secretary Marsha Fudge. I was on a call with her recently and feel very excited about the possibilities. I think she is ready to turn that agency upside down. We are, you know, we're talking about a national crisis right now around affordable housing. And I think that we have a president and we have a HUD Secretary who are going to be, who want to solve this crisis, and also understand the disparity. They understand that Native people have some of the highest rates of housing instability. They understand that Black folks have the same kind of issues. And let's be clear, it's because of racism. It is because of gentrification. It's because of redlining practices that were systemic racist practices that we now have to overcome. And keep in mind that they did all that on Native land as well. So I am just wanting to, you know, applaud everyone's efforts around tiny home villages and know that it's part of the process. And for every tiny home village that we put up, for every unit of tiny homes, let's put up 20, you know, permanent housing, or be sure that we don't limit ourselves when we get into a scarcity model. Sure, tiny home villages are good for right now, but for every, you know, community that's building tiny homes, they should be building the permanent housing. And I know from very personal experience that it's very hard, right? Like when I first decided that I wanted to try to build housing with my community here in Seattle, it was, I mean, unbelievable barriers. Like they pushed every barrier at us as much as they could. But it's so important that we have, you know, Native folks out there who are just saying, no, we deserve to build and own and operate our own housing that responds to the cultural needs of our community. And it is unacceptable that Native people have the highest rates of homelessness, and we're going to fight like hell for them, and we're going to build out real affordable housing that honors, you know, every individual. And I could keep just going on this because it's so important, but I want to add really quickly you know, Nicholas started talking about families, and that is something that's very important for us to be thinking about. You know, we have a lot of, you know, kids that have been in the foster care system, and I was thinking when Nicholas was sharing about this family that some of my case managers at the Chief Seattle Club had run into one day. It was two Native, you know, young people, I think in their mid-20s. They had both aged out of foster care, and they were really successful. They were working. They had two kids. They were like an eight-month-old and maybe a three-year-old. And they had the kids in daycare, and the kids were just taken care of so well. But they lived in their car. And the reason they did that is they were so afraid to go to the mainstream services because they had been in the foster care system. And so they were really stressed that if they went to try to get help for their housing instability, that their kids would be taken away from them. And so it's so important. And so the Chief Seattle Club, again, just an incredible agency led by my friend Derek Belgard, the Chief Seattle Club was able to get them into, you know, a hotel room that night, and then 3 weeks later get them into, you know, an apartment, and now, you know, they're thriving. They just needed that down payment and, you know, some initial cash assistance, and now they're just doing so great. So it's really important to remember those systems that have harmed our community, and we have to make sure that we have cultural appropriate responses for folks like that family I was just describing.
Well, thank you so much for that. A lot of really good points, Colleen, especially, you know, reminding us about federal trust responsibility and looking at the federal government and the different administrations as they come in, and different people who are appointed to these different positions, and also reminding them a lot of education a lot of times, too, if they're not familiar with, you know, tribal nations. Thanks, Colleen, for that. I want to now introduce another guest who's joining us from Wisconsin is Maria Haskins, and she's a community organizer and human trafficking outreach coordinator for Mini Kanikum Community Rebuilders. Hello, welcome to Native America Calling, Maria.
Good morning, how are you? Or good afternoon, I should say.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and tell us a little bit about the initiative there where you're at with the tiny homes. You are looking to build them there in the community. Is that right?
Yeah. So first, I just want to say thank you and then apologize for coming in kind of halfway through the call. I have a sick baby at home, and with COVID right now, we have a lot of restrictions in place still. So I'm home and I'm working, and I'm sure a lot of other people are going through that same thing at this point in time. But So Mini Kanikum, we are trying to build tiny homes. The initiative that we have started is called Tiny Homes for Healing. And so what we were trying to do, or what we are trying to do, is, and I had heard somebody mention it being a multi-pronged approach, and that is absolutely true, I feel like, and building these villages within our Indigenous communities, because we wanted to tackle a number of issues while working with this. And so the first issue that we were looking at was, you know, the obvious of homelessness. A lot of our Indigenous people are homeless, you know, within our community. And, you know, there's that right, or, you know, basic need of housing to help somebody thrive and flourish. So we also understood that while addressing homelessness, that it was, you know, there were AODA issues going on, probably mental health issues going on. And then somebody had mentioned the foster care system. We have a lot of kids who, you know, I shouldn't say a lot, but we have some, you know, families who are getting locked into the foster system, but oftentimes they're leaving off of the reservation and going into those homes. And then more times than not, they're aging out of the system. And so looking at how we can provide that housing security to them. And then the one thing that we're working pretty hard on right now is our organization was a recipient, sub-recipient for a human trafficking grant to do some outreach work. And so the two tiny homes that we're looking to finish right now are to house those who are survivors of sexual assault and or human trafficking. So right now we have one home that's completed, but it was our pilot home. There's really not much to it. There's no plumbing, you know, there's not a bathroom in there. But we are able to provide electricity. So there have been some people who have stayed there, and we just kind of hook up that tiny home with like a trailer cord. I'm not too sure what the exact name of it is, but Nonetheless, people are able to use, like, you know, a window air conditioner or a space heater to keep it warm. And then we're able to offer the main house as a means of showering, cooking food. And then the two homes that we're finishing right now, again, you know, we ran into the issue of it seemed like they were just kind of two more pilot homes. But again, there's no, you know, bathroom, there's no plumbing. There's a small area where somebody could put like a microwave, but we might be able to furnish it with like a microwave and a hot plate for people to be able to eat. But just as the lady had mentioned before, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. But, you know, there was the struggle of, you know, these homes don't have bathrooms and they don't have, you know, full kitchen areas. And I completely echo what was said about, you know, we want these tiny homes to be able to address all of these issues from a multi-pronged approach. But what is one of the struggles is that these aren't meant to be long-term housing. And although we want to be able to make sure that our people are safe and that they're having something that's long-term, but these tiny homes are really meant to be transitional and made for on an emergency basis. And then, you know, she was absolutely right when it says then we have to look beyond that, because it's, you know, what are we going to make sure that they go into next? You know, we don't want to keep taking our people and taking them from home to shelter and then to another home and then maybe there's another facility. We don't want to do that, because then we're just layering more traumas on top of one another, you know, from what's already there. So it's like, you know, how can we begin to look beyond that scope of tiny homes that are absolutely wonderful and that can provide, you know, the need right here and now, but what is that going to look like beyond that? And, you know, there's a lot of different things that we would like to do within the community. Like, we're also looking at solar energy. We have an initiative called Energy Sovereignty. And so we, you know, we have some solar panels, you know, over at our organization that we're able to operate off of 100%. But we're looking at how can we help the community become completely solar energy, you know, and in doing that, you know, kicking revenue back and then providing jobs for some of our community members, you know, how is that going to have a positive impact to, you know, bring forward more opportunities for housing and things like that. So our tiny homes, we're still looking for more funding to continue with the building of them. Like I said, we have what I would say like 2.5. At this point in time, but we're definitely looking for more funding so we can continue to build them. And then, you know, we're also looking for a way to secure some type of funding.
Hold that thought real quick, Maria. We got to go to a quick break. You're listening to Native America Calling. We'll be right back.
As COVID-19 vaccines are becoming available, Americans are eager to learn more, but frustrated about where to find answers. That's why AARP is working to protect Americans 50-plus by connecting you to the latest information. You can learn who's eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine in your state, when, where, and how to get it, and what you might want to discuss with your doctor at aarp.org/vaccineinfo. AARP supports this program.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. We're focusing on tiny homes as an option to help people transition during the time they're experiencing homelessness. Does your tribe have one of these? Maybe you've even been a resident in one of these, or maybe you're in a neighborhood and you have some concerns you want to bring up. We have 3 guests, and we also have some callers on the line. We invite you to call in. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And I'd like to welcome back our guests, Ilsa Beal, Colleen Echohawk, and also Maria Haskins. And Maria, I want to give you a chance to wrap up your thoughts. Sorry we had to cut you off because we had to get to break, but you were saying that you have a couple homes in the works there, tiny homes, but you're also working on a larger project. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Maria.
Oh, yeah, not a problem. So we're like I was saying before, we're just looking to secure more funding so that we can expand our project. And then not only expand it, but to secure staff so that we have people who are, you know, readily available to help provide those land-based services, because that's what we're doing with those, you know, with the tiny homes is, you know, we're wanting to provide land-based services and, you know, trying to not charge any type of like rent. We're looking at having people do what we call sweat equity, basically working on the grounds of the Mekonikan, whether it's in the gardens or participating, you know, helping facilitate women's groups and things like that. So there's a lot of policies, like protocols and things that need to be, you know, really ironed out right now. So that's really where we are in the project. So if there's suggestions, I'm completely open to them. And I welcome any type of feedback for them.
Thank you, Maria. And this is on the Menominee Nation in Wisconsin. I want to go to the phone lines now and get some callers in on this conversation. You still have time. We still have a little bit of time here on Native America Calling today, talking about tiny homes as some transitional housing options for unsheltered relatives. Give us a call. Our phone lines are open. It's 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go to Susan calling us from Bethel, Alaska, listening to us on KYUK. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Good morning. Well, it's the show's at 9 o'clock out here in the morning. So good morning. I do believe the value of transitional housing, and I know it's temporary, but people need to be able and comfortable enough to stay long enough to address their issues. I mean, that is so important. And one of the ideas that I've been kicking around is it follows the tiny home concept, only it's tiny apartments. And these apartments would have full-size bathrooms, bathtub and all that, full-size bathroom. And the reason for that is the humidity buildup in an apartment situation. And the other reason for that is we could convert any hotel or motel maybe into one of these situations where there's tiny apartments. Each room becomes up with a built-in furniture concept and all that, a tiny apartment for a small family, maybe even a large family, but a family or a couple. And they could stay in this tiny apartment. Again, long enough, it's comfortable. It's got running water and all that, comfortable and long enough so they can address whatever issues they have and save up enough money for apartment down payments or whatever the situation or goal is. So I do believe in transitional housing, but they also need to have the idea that they can be there long enough, you know, a year or 2 years, I don't know. It can't be a concept of, well, here I am, can buy me some time to be in survivor mode. It needs to have that atmosphere to it. Also, I just think there's a lot of hotels and motels that may be available to be converted into these with minimal costs and construction. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for calling us from Bethel, Alaska. Let's go to Cleo calling in from Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to us on KUNM. Hi, Cleo. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, hey. Say, Cleo Terry, she's got this at me. She's not going to change. I'm sorry, that's another assistant that's on it. That's a change. Hello, everybody. I'm Cleo. I just introduced myself. I'm from the Tangle Clan, born from the Midhouse Clan. My paternal grandfolks are from the Middle Clan, and my maternal grandfolks are from the Bear Clan, from the Hopi Nation. I just wanted to comment on transitional housing and little homes. I once was in transition between homes at one point in my life, and I was able to stay in a somewhat tiny home. It was a shack, one of those prefabricated sheds, and it really gave me a lot of dignity and rest to be able to go home and rest for a little bit, do my laundry, and have shelter over my head in between traveling in my vehicle or staying in my vehicle. So I think it's really important and pertinent, even if it's with or without plumbing and services, because the place I stayed in didn't have plumbing, nor did I have electricity, but it was doable. I had an electrical, a portable lamp, and was able to go inside the building, the main house, to use the restroom. So I just think it's really important, not only for the shelter perspective, but also to give you a sense of dignity and a positive outlook on how you can rise back up from being unsheltered. From that point to now, I am remarkably like 10 steps ahead of where I've been. So now I am with the Red Nation. It's an organization, an anti-profit organization that helps to, and there's so many different perspectives, but the part that I take part of a lot is mutual aid in forms of PPE, taking out food for the unsheltered relatives, our unsheltered relatives, and just giving that sense of you're important and you're sacred. And I just think all these combined and all these efforts combined helps people, because I know I was on the receiving end of these programs at one time and point in my life, and now I'm able to give back. And I just think it's really, really important that we get these programs going and support one another in helping on unsheltered relatives. That's my intake and my perspective on that.
Thank you so much, Cleo, for calling in and sharing some of the work, and also just sharing your very personal story of, and I can hear the passion in your voice too, is why you do this work. Thank you, Cleo, for calling in, listening to us at KUNM here in Albuquerque. I want to now welcome Candace, who is also from the Lummi Nation. I want to welcome you to the program, and you just heard from a couple callers talking about hotels and also just talking about ending that stigma against homelessness and then giving back to the community. Candace, welcome.
Hello, Haishkasiam, Nasjalachasiam, Kwanstanat, Sinasnat. I'm Candace Wilson. I'm the executive director for the Lactamish Foundation. So the work that we are doing with the Lummi Stepping Stones and the Eagle Haven Cottage Villages is phenomenal. And I commend all of our callers and our speakers today addressing these matters in Indian country, because it's so important. It's imperative. We have always believed in taking care of our people, no matter where they are at, whether it's on the reservation or off the reservation. Unfortunately, here at Lummi, the cost of living within Whatcom County is one of the highest in the state of Washington. And so forcing us to live off the reservation where we don't want to be, but with building cottages like this on the reservation to help our people stay where they want to be and live and reside will help with their overall health and wellness, helping with life skills, financial literacy, training, education, wraparound services with a cottage style that has a bathroom, a kitchen, washer and dryer, at this identified location. But what we hope to do is to continue to build upon this and connect with our housing services for that are under the Lummi Tribal Housing Authority, and to help people build on their own property of that of what we have left. So it's, you know, I'm really thankful just to be able to share the good work. And I look forward to see how the other tribes and tribal organizations are doing with their tiny homes or cottage villages that they are developed and developing. So thank you all for the good work. And just wanted to share a little bit as the nonprofit, tribally chartered entity of Lummi Nation.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and thank you for sharing some of that and for joining us today to talk about that. We're getting close to the end of the hour here, and I want to also thank all the callers. But Ilsa, I wanted to ask a little bit about some of the, maybe even some of the pushback that the tiny homes have received.
Yeah, it was quite difficult to find the site. There was the normal NIMBYism. We were trying to explain to the communities what we're trying to do. I also want to make a distinction between a tiny home and a tiny home village. I do hear the concerns about just a tiny home, perhaps not providing enough of the dignity. But then one of the callers also quite rightfully explained how much that stability meant to her and how that did give her dignity. But it was a bit of a foreign concept here in Albuquerque, so it took a while. When we eventually did find the site, when the Albuquerque Indian Center invited us to build next to their center, we could see that the tide was changing, because then we could start planning, showing the plans, the architectural plans. People had a better idea that this village is all about dignity, is all about community. We're trying to nurture self-governance. We're also not time-limiting people. So if people need to stay there for 7 years, then we welcome the villagers to do so. Some villagers have got chronic pain, so they can't just easily find a job elsewhere, move elsewhere. We're there to accompany them. And then also we're now working on bringing in micro-industry so that we actually bring into the village the earning potential, because it's very easy to just say, oh, just go and find a job. It's not always so easy for folks to be able to do so. And the neighbors were just scared. Someone mentioned the stigma. Nicholas mentioned the stigma attached to just the mere fact that someone doesn't have the traditional four walls and a roof, and then they're lesser than. And yes, I agree, we need to work really hard and continue to work hard to provide that permanent affordable housing. But we also need to work on the public perception so that people don't automatically think this person is not a human being any longer. We can only be okay once we are all okay. And in order to get there, the tiny home village concept is just one of the alternatives that we need. We need a whole array of these types of interventions that might then just provide people with the necessary dignity and just allow them to hang on a little bit longer until the permanent affordable housing becomes available, because there aren't enough permanent housing units and there's seldomly enough political will to get the units going.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And Ilse Beal, thank you for joining us here talking about the tiny home village in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I want to give our other two guests a minute to share their final thought. Maria Haskins, working on this issue in Menominee Nation in Wisconsin. Maria, your final thought.
As far as barriers go, the only barriers that we have really come to face is people think some in the community, like, oh, Minneconnican's only taking care of their own. They're not going to help out the rest of the community. And that's just some people being, unaware of really what the whole project is about. And I guess my final thoughts with that is that, everybody has an inherent right to have housing. We need to have our basic needs addressed, and people should not, in my own personal opinion, is struggle with those very basic needs, such as food, clothing, shelter. I've said this to other people, and I'll say it again, is that, many years ago, prior to, pre-contact even, we were people that took care of one another and made sure that we were all okay, and so that's what I would just like to see done, because I would like to see us as a people, push forward collectively and have those basic needs addressed so that everybody has the ability to flourish, because everybody's life means something and they're put on this earth for a reason.
Well, thank you so much, Maria Haskins, for joining us here today on Native America Calling. And also, Colleen Echohawk, thank you for joining us. Your final thought.
Oh, I just want to say thank you so much for having me today, and just what brilliance is on this call today. I just wanted to go back to the comment from Barrow or Bethel, sorry, Bethel, Alaska, about the hotel, or the hotel idea. You know, hoteling is something that's really surprising, like, all the national experts who, you know, through COVID, we have, you know, thousands and thousands of people across the country who are experiencing homelessness went into hotel rooms. And it was sort of, it's kind of like a tiny home village, like the idea of the village concept. So I just wanted to say that I think it's a brilliant idea. I hope that, you know, Native organizations around the country will be able to access those resources and get some of their folks moved into hotels. I know that my colleagues at the T Seattle Club here in Seattle have a 70-room hotel that is just full of Native people, and it's just going so well. In fact, the folks in the neighborhood love it and are excited about it. So I just think Great. The continued innovation and supporting our folks. So thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you so much, Colleen Echohawk. And you've been listening to Native America Calling. We're talking about different innovations and ideas to address unsheltered relatives. We have a full lineup for the rest of the week. I hope you tune in, give us a call. Thank you to the crew at the station, and thank you to all the guests and the callers. We've reached the end today. Join us tomorrow. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention remind you, receiving the COVID-19 vaccination protects you, your family, and your community, and urge you to please contact your tribal or urban clinic to get your COVID-19 vaccination if you haven't already. More information at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
Buju, Anishwa ishi chigen ba aje gekinua maguzing, gego maji ta ken gishi ta siwan. Oda baji bawigun, bindige biaga zod. Gonoje no kid in ishinabi akosi begamigung no waj jigikain de man. Mawadishiwain, healthcare.gov, gema ganoj, 1-800-318-2596. Gaundinagadeg, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.